I want to begin by saying that my understanding of the brethren is very much as an outsider. I happen to have been christened as a Methodist, which, by the way, if they're right, I've got a better chance than you. So I really come to this as an outsider. Now, I married a blue blood. She's a third generation. That gives me a little bit of a chance. But there are many people who tell me, I think with much seriousness, that I don't really understand the system. I have also been thoroughly spoilt because my association with Australian Assemblies has been with Inala and Kenmore, and both have been marvellous experiences. I am not sure that everybody who's grown up within the Assembly could say the same thing. And what's more, after 36 years a Christian and a believer in Assemblies, I'm still there. I ought to wear a badge. We all ought to wear a badge. Anyone who can survive 35 years in the Brethren ought to be given something very, very special. Now, that brings me to the task I set out to do about 7 years ago. And I set out to write a history of the Brethren. Now, I very deliberately called it a history. You'd have to be more arrogant than myself to try and write the history of the Brethren, which I'm sure will escape us all. We are so extremely diverse. If somebody else had written this, they would have done it quite differently. But even if I'm finished and find little flaws now and things I wished I'd said differently or other things which I've added, I'm still reasonably happy with what has been produced. For 6 years, I almost did nothing but read every missionary tidings from 1911. Every Assembly links and all of these magazines in his name from Western Australia, but copies of all of these, and tried to read everything. Now what happens then is you get such a vast mass of information, you say, how can this ever be sort of controlled and handled? And that's one of the biggest problems for writing a history and in fact for understanding our tradition. So I spent, as I say, almost 6 years sorting out all of this and then finally putting something together. Now, for those of you who want to read something about the Brethren, let me just say a couple things about writings. One of the best histories is that by Neatby, which was written in 1901. It's not available now, and you'd have to find it only in a few libraries. But if you've got the time, he was a man of great scholarship. His father was an influential, exclusive preacher. He himself had almost moved, well, I think he'd moved out of the exclusive Brethren and was no longer even in the open, and he's rather critical of what we would now call the open Brethren. But it is an extremely well-written history of the Brethren. Much later, the man Napoleon Knoll wrote two volumes, which I suggest you leave on the shelf. Even Ironsides, which I note is back there, is not a marvellous history to read. He himself moved into, was part of the exclusive Brethren and finally moved out of it. It has a lot of North American biases and would be of greater interest to North Americans than it is to Britishers or Australians. But there are some insights there, but watch the bias from which Ironside is coming, because he is very critical of what we would now call open Brethren. Already we've made reference to the book by Roy Code, and unquestionably that is the best history that's around, written about 1967. But it is still worth reading, and if you want to understand something of the ethos by a man who I think reflected the very best of Brethrenism, read Roy Code's History of the Brethren. Harold Rowden's Origins of the Brethren, which came out a year later, is much more expansive and only treats the very first part of the tradition. Now, that now brings me to talking about the Brethren in Australia. And the rationale for this is that in some way they have helped mould what we are today, although in many ways we are not what they were. And I'm hoping two things are going to happen. First of all, we'll begin to ask questions like, what did they do and how successful it was? Are we doing these things? Can we learn from them? And if not, can we contextualise what they're doing? Now, I do not think we ought to read history in order that we can duplicate it. But we must contextualise it. That is, see what it did, its form, what it was trying to say, and then bring it into the 20th century and say, we will take the best of that and we will give it new cultural forms or new clothing. Now, I have described the history of the Brethren movement in Australia in five stages. It begins with emigrants, or immigrants from outside who came to Australia possibly as early as 1850. Now, these came from what would have been called Brethren assemblies, both open and exclusive in England, in Ireland, and in Scotland. The people who came were quite diverse. Some of them were quite open, some of them were already by the 50s becoming quite rigid. These people came, they often met up with each other, and they began small house churches. They didn't build gospel halls until probably the 70s or the 80s. But for 20, 30, 40, 30 years, many of these people just existed, talking about their ideas and having fellowship in small family groups. For instance, Philip Kitchen was one of the early people who came out in the 1850s. He went on to be editor of a very influential Christian magazine called Word and Work in Victoria. I think it was very sad that ultimately it seemed this man was forced out of the assemblies by a man called Rice T. Hopkins, who came with some very rigid ideas influenced by needed truth, and Philip Kitchen finally moved out into Baptist circles. In the 1850s, a man called Philip Robinson came out. He was just a layman, met with some assemblies in Melbourne, and finally moved across to Singapore, and is very well known in Singapore circles, although he's been dead a long time, for beginning Brethren assemblies in Singapore. And so there is this movement then of somebody from England to Australia, and then 7 years later moving across to Singapore and being quite dynamic really in establishing assemblies in Singapore. So that there were a number of assemblies quite early in our history, and this is when the first immigrants were coming to Australia, at least the first three.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
We hope not too many of our people came out with the convict clans. Now, mind you, we had a good chance because Brethren hadn't even formed in 1788 when the first convicts came anyhow. So that we didn't have much chance of sending them out. But it was with the free settlers that the first of these Brethren came, and so that some of those early house churches, and that's what they essentially were established out of those immigrant families. The second way by which Brethren churches were planted in Australia was by what I've called trans-denominational transfer growth. That's a mouthful, isn't it? What it means simply is this, that people change denominations. Now, whilst that is a frequent occurrence today, and even our own people find it quite easy if they wish, if they don't like what's happening, to move across to a Baptist church or an Anglican church or a Uniting church. And I know dozens of people in Brisbane have done this, have moved across and felt much freer, quite free about doing that these days. It was not a thing that was common in the 19th century. And people did it at considerable expense often to their family relationships and to their circle of friends. Because often, if you changed a denomination in the 19th century, you really were ostracised. It meant that people thought through the implications of this, but there is no doubt that a number of people did it with great conviction. If you've read anything of the origin of the Tasmanian assemblies, and there has been some exciting history written down there by Alan Dyer and other people, one of the most influential was an Anglican minister called Richard Smith. He met with some of the early Brethren and was part of a conference which was obviously interdenominational, that is, a whole lot of churches came together to form a Keswick-type conference in Tasmania in the early 70s. But by 1876, I think it was, he, and by the way, he'd been an Anglican minister for 15 years, brought himself, his family, and a number of his congregation into the Brethren. And he spent the rest of his life ministering amongst Brethren churches, no longer as the Reverend Richard Smith, but as Mr. Richard Smith, full-time worker for the Brethren. Now, this kind of thing gave good theological insight into some of the preaching that was going to go and input into Tasmanian assemblies. In Sydney itself, a very influential person called Henry Martin was also an Anglican clergyman. He moved into the Brethren and began a Bible school in Sydney at Stanmore. It may well have been the first Bible school in Australia. And it was begun by somebody who had picked up Brethren ideas. And you can tell that because if you read one of his reports, he has modelled it on the George Mueller idea. The report is very much something like a report of the Lord's dealings with the Bible College at Stanmore, which is very similar to a report of the Lord's dealings with George Mueller. He didn't charge anybody anything for coming. Everybody was expected to find that the Lord would provide for them. And it was very much a Mueller model. Now, one considers that in 1957 or 56, and Cedric will probably pick me up on this, when Emmaus was being kicked around, there was huge opposition to this idea of Brethren establishing a Bible school. Who ever thought about it? After all, there aren't any of those in the Bible. And just here, back at the beginning of the 20th century, one of the first Bible colleges in Australia, in fact, was begun by people who were influenced by Mueller and by the Brethren and by this man, Henry Martin. Now, I'm not sure how long it continued. Maybe it did not continue for very long, but some of the early Brethren missionaries who went out at the turn of the century were trained in that Bible school here at Stanmore in New South Wales. Henry Martin went across to Tasmania, and certainly I've got writings of his in 1910 where he reports on ministry that he exercised amongst Tasmanian assemblies. So here is another Anglican minister who's moved across from his own denomination into the Brethren, and as I say, there would have been considerable ostracising of him from past friends because of that move, because the Brethren were always thought to have been radicals, if not ratbags. There is also the record, at the same time, of a Sidney Cave, who was an Anglican minister in New South Wales, who also came into the movement. There are also records of keen evangelical laymen who came to Australia with the Methodists and other churches, who discovered the Brethren here and who made a move into our circles. And I suspect that for people who had made the translocation from England and came here and were often on their own, it was much easier to move and to make this change than it would have been in their own countries. I think the same thing happens today in terms of mission, that often, say, a Muslim person or a person, a Hindu in India, who is thinking about Christianity may find it very hard in their own country to make a move, but if they come to Australia without a whole lot of other society constraints, may find it much easier to move into our churches or to change some kind of religious affiliation. Now, I suspect that happened in terms of a number of these evangelical lay people who found it easier in the 19th and beginning of the 20th century to move into our circles. Now, if you want me to make a comment here and something you might like to think about, one of the huge tragedies in our time, our generation, is there is no longer an inflow of people with theological training, of ministers from outside who are suddenly saying, hey, you Brethren guys have got it all. I shouldn't say any Brethren guys, you Brethren families, men and women have got it all. What are we finding today? The tragedy is we're finding an exodus. And show me some of the good Baptist churches in Queensland, and I'll show you either a Brethren pastor or an ex-Brethren pastor, or certainly a lot of Brethren leadership in those churches. I mean, the assembly that I went to and had so much to do with starting has had something like, I think it's 5 full-time workers in its history, and 2 of those today are very quite well-known Baptist pastors. Now, there is this exodus, and one of the questions I want you to think about at the end of this is, why did people come to us in the 19th and earlier 20th century, and now, why are these leaders? Now, I'm not talking about just rank and file, I'm talking about leadership. I mean, we profited by the coming in of this leadership, but we are now suffering at times from its exodus. So, first of all, there were the immigrants who came out, and they just brought what they had and said, we're going to be the same. There were these other people, however, who are here and who are changing across denominations, and some of these brought congregations or small parts of congregations with them. The third way by which the brethren grew, and this was by far the most influential, was through itinerant preachers. Now, I'm not sure how much you have stopped to read biographies of people in the past. I, certainly in my 20s, read literally dozens of biographies of Christian people, and I found them stimulating. The worst thing is, I think it took me to India. That it gave me a missionary vision by reading these biographies of great Christians. And I've still got lots of them on my shelves, and every now and then I pick up one again and read it. Now, we ought to somehow get back and see what God has done in the lives of people. And I found it very interesting to read back now the short histories we've got of some of these people who in the 1860s came to Australia and began to share their faith, and out of which our brethren church has emerged. You can read the story of Walter Douglas. He was a Britisher who came not because he was brethren, for he was not. He was very much independent and wanted to go on preach wherever he had the freedom. But he came to both Australia, to Tasmania particularly, and New Zealand. He stirred up all kinds of trouble in Tasmania, so much that he was jailed for disturbing the peace. Now, his main offence was preaching the gospel. He maybe did it with considerable offence. He got stuck into anybody and everybody, and sounded, say, brethren in some of his ways, like proclaimed about any kind of insurance policies. So other people picked up that, it's not just one of our oddities. But the important thing about this man, Walter Douglas, is that after he had gone through and he made a huge impact, and obviously the Spirit of God was with his preaching and following him and people were converted, but he was one of these, come-go evangelists. And he left behind almost a whole lot of confused people. We've made this decision, what do we do? Now, it was very fortunate that a number of people who'd been influenced by the brethren came out from England and they began to follow these people up and established assemblies. For instance, Charles Perrin. Now, Perrin had come to Australia, obviously, quite a lad at 17, and that would have been a big trip in the 1850s. He came out here, then went back. He was a pagan then. He went back and finally came back with his wife, came to Melbourne, then went to Tasmania and spent 7 years preaching. Now, if you read the story, you read the story of a man who has an absolute passion for sharing his faith. And if we sometimes wonder why we seem to be going nowhere, it's because we don't have this singleness of vision and this total passion which these people had. By the way, the passion meant that by 33 years of age, he was dead. He wore himself out as he made journeys all around Tasmania on horseback, rain, pelted at by Catholic Sikh reports, and yet he saw blessing. And undoubtedly this was the seed which developed a large number of churches in the north of Tasmania. There were other people like William Brown, and if you want to take time to have a look at that history, and by the way, I did sneak 3 copies into my bag. Now, I don't think the history itself will be published, that is, except that we are photocopying it, and it's costing me up there about $35 to photocopy plus spiral bind it. As I said, I brought 3. I promised Ray and Scott one after that. There are 2 left there, and anybody who wants to buy those, you're welcome to have it. And but look at it first, then buy it untried. But it will give you the history of a number of these people, and maybe you ought to get excited about some of them. There were some top people Read the story of Henry Rainey, who worked in Melbourne. He came from Ireland. He wanted to be a missionary to the American Negroes, but they said he wasn't healthy enough, so they sent him to Australia. Now, when we chuckle at that, and it was meant to be chuckled at, that's exactly what happened to the evangelisation of Australia, not only by the brethren, but in fact by all of the denominations. And if you read today historians who are talking about Australia and why we're where we're at, they will say in the 19th century, all of the mission societies sent their best people to South America, to India, to Africa. I mean, that was where the glamour was. Who wanted to go and be a missionary to Australia? And it is shown by, at times, the calibre of some of the people who came here. Now, I'm not saying the calibre of the early brethren, but certainly the Anglicans and the Catholics. I mean, the Catholics had some great people who they sent and made huge impacts in the world, what we would call the Third World. But most of the early Catholic people that were sent here were almost discards. And the Catholic Church struggled for its first 30 or 40 years until it suddenly realised that they had to send some top calibre people here. And perhaps the Anglicans were almost in the same boat. But Henry Rainey then wanted to go out to the American Negroes, in fact was not allowed to do it, so he came to Australia. He only worked here for 7 years, again dying at 31 years of age. I don't think from the story he was married, but it seems that he again spent those 7 years doing nothing but going out and sharing his faith, and moving from place to place, talking about the gospel. It's interesting to read also the stories of these people, because I'll talk about preaching in Presbyterian halls, in Methodist halls, in Baptist halls. They didn't have a circle of brethren congregations, and it seems they had acceptance in all of those places. So it was a different ecclesiastical world, different religious world than it is now. But it was marvellous that these people could do those things. Harrison Ord was a person who'd proved himself in England. He'd preached there for 18 years with great blessing. Thousands of people had gone out to see him in England. But at just about, I think it was 42 when his wife died, and he was shattered. Not only that, he lost his voice. And he thought that his days of preaching were over. So what do? You come out to Australia. Now, by the time he'd arrived in Australia after the boat trip, apparently his voice got back. And within a short time, he had congregations or crowds of 4,000 to 5,000 people meeting in the Melbourne City Hall to hear him preach. Now, that must have made a big impact on the Christian community in Melbourne in the 1880s. He finally retired to Geelong and after 30 years of ministry, passed on. John Hambleton, a converted actor, came out after 35 years of preaching in UK and spent 10 years here preaching. So there are the stories of these people, and sometimes it's worth going back and looking at their zeal, at their intensity, their total involvement, their abandonment. And it was a kind of life that very few of us can live today. And I'm not sure that we should necessarily call ourselves to that. But if we are saying, why did it work then and not now? One of the reasons is the calibre of people, the commitment and the abandonment that those people made of everything in order to pursue this goal and task of sharing the gospel. All of the people I've mentioned so far have been foreigners. That is, they were British or Irish or Scottish. They came from there. But by the 1880s and 1890s, there suddenly emerged generations of Australian evangelists. John Baird was a man who worked in Victoria and who I've listed as the first. He may not have been the first, but certainly in a lot of the records that I picked up, maybe we should think about him as the first. He was converted in 1880. He met John Hambleton, and John Hambleton was the converted actor who, amongst other things, bought out, well, used anyhow, a Bible carriage. And these were horse-drawn vehicles which moved around the country selling Bibles. The poor missioner had to live in it. So it was his home, it was his job, it was his business. He had to sell a bit of literature, and by this he could perhaps pay for a little bit of food and so on. It was his pulpit. And so these carriages moved all around Victoria, a little bit New South Wales, and a lot about Queensland as well as in Tasmania. And so he moved into one of these, and its record in an obituary said that he worked in this for 47 years. And he is credited with visiting every town, city, village in Victoria during those 47 years of ministry. Now that is faithfulness. And there's an obituary, a record from the Bible Society talking about the huge amount of literature he had distributed on their behalf. In Sydney, you had a man like Fred Woods. He was commended, in fact, by the South Brisbane Assembly and came down here. At 19 years of age, he entered full-time Christian work. Now, you can probably look around the assembly at people these days who are 19 years of age. We've hardly let them out of school. In fact, many of them are still at school now. We keep them in school for longer and longer because we don't know what to do with them. But you see, here's a guy at 19 years of age, gives up everything and will spend the rest of his life in Christian ministry. By 1922, he began what was called the People's Gospel Mission in Sydney, and he took over a theatre Sunday nights, and every Sunday night, or most Sunday nights, for the next 10 months, he personally preached. One man ministry, sounds like to me. But you see, this was his giftedness, and he preached. And this was a great attempt now to bring people from outside into this theatre so that they could so that they could hear the gospel. It was his son that went on to become head of InterVarsity Fellowship in the United States, a man called Stacy Woods. And it was very interesting to go to Vancouver and to meet his grandson, Stephen, who's now a missionary in Italy. So three generations rising out, or two further generations out of this Woods family, all committed in different ways to the gospel. Well, in the words of Hebrew, time fails to tell of the great faithful works of men like Frank Bates or Edward Fleechman or John Hind or Captain Elsie or Fred Tobey. Fred Tobey interested me as I read him because I found that he played interstate cricket for both New South Wales and Tasmania, and that was something a little bit close to my heart, not New South Wales or Tasmania, but the idea of interstate cricket. You might also be interested to know, as a first, that he and his wife graduated from Melbourne Bible Institute in 1922, and in fact were the first married couple allowed to go through that institute. And they were brethren. So there you are. He worked with John Baird in Victoria and then went on to minister like Baird for 34 years. Huge involvement of time and ministry. Now, so the patterns then were, first of all, immigrants who came out and established house churches and shared their faith. I don't think they grew very much. They were very much just trying to hold what they had from the past. Secondly, you have the people who transferred, who were other Christians here, other denominations, and came across to the brethren. And they were some of the best propagators of the new ideas because they were really committed to it. Thirdly, then you have the outreach by these workers who worked hard and long and selflessly as they shared their faith. Now, from about 1960, everything changed. And we need to recognise the huge difference that this change made. Now, I've suggested that there were some new sociological changes happening in Australia. Some for good, some for bad. It was the age of television. But it was also the age when it suddenly became important that you educated your children. You can read the story of some of the Queensland evangelists, Todd, for instance, Bruce Todd, who wandered around Queensland in a van. Now it was mechanised. He took his children The children missed a lot of school. Schooling wasn't really important. And sometimes these children began to suffer. And by the 60s, workers began to say, hey, listen, maybe it's not right for us to wander from place to place all the time, to constantly put pressure on our family and on our children. And so there came the desire to settle down. And so you have a model now of a resident evangelist, but often he is no longer an evangelist, but a teacher. And at the same time, there was this subtle move from let's reach Australia or whatever it is by evangelism to let's reach Australia by teaching. And even some of these people who were previously evangelists began more and more to go to assemblies and set up teaching programs. And they might talk about future things. Now, they wanted this to be gospel, but in fact it was essentially teaching for the church, and they hoped some people came in. And so there was a huge shift, I suggest, from the idea of evangelism as a way to reach the outside people to that of let's teach the gospel. Well, let's teach anyhow. And so you'll find a whole range of people in the 50s and 60s are better known for teachers rather than evangelists. But they certainly also settled down. And so there was a need for a more settled ministry. There are a number of objections raised. For instance, if you stay in one place, won't most of your support come from that church? It never did, but everybody thought it might. And so people said they shouldn't get all their support from one church. That's not very good. They're no longer trusting God. They're looking to that church. Or, if you just have a local full-time worker there, won't he dominate the local believers? And what's more, won't the assemblies come just like the churches? You won't be able to tell the difference, because like the churches, they'll have their own pastors. Now, these were things that were said in the 60s, 70s, and perhaps they're still being said today, as we're struggling with new models of assemblies and how we reach out into the community. Now, if you're looking for where all this started, again, you might be able to help me. I made some guesses, and again, all I could do was read all the information that I could find, and there's a lot more information out there, and came up with two places. First of all, in early 1960 or 61, Wattle Park appointed Patty Goodfellow as a full-time worker to reach children in the Sunday school. Now, here we have a church which is appointing a single person. Would you believe it, a lady? We won't talk about that too loudly, will we? A lady as a full-time worker to work within this church. Now, it may almost have been the first church which has appointed somebody just to work within them. And that was her brief. By 1965, Wattle Park had appointed Keith Young as a youth worker. That's another nice way around it. You appoint a youth worker, you see. Now, gradually these people grow up to be pastors, but as long as it's a youth worker, I think in the 60s we could handle that. And it was not until 71 that at least Wattle Park moved to appoint their first pastor, and that's what they called him, and that was Bruce Morgan, Morton rather, who happened to be an ex-missionary pilot. I think it was from Borneo. Now, it's interesting to look at an assembly like Wattle Park, which was reasonably progressive, at least in terms of what it did structurally, if not theologically, and it came up with this model then of beginning to appoint people from within its community that would serve that church. And I guess Wattle Park today still have some full-time workers. The other experience that I wrote about in the history was one that was fairly close to me, because the assembly that I went to in Inala in 1961 appointed me as a full-time worker. Now, I was just 21 years of age, so it was fairly radical to do that, and I looked after the assembly. I had 17 meetings every week, which kept me busy, including 3 or 4 Bible studies, and a Sunday school then which numbered probably about 500 children. So it was a rather large work. And by the way, of those 500 children, 30 came from brethren families. The rest were all rank outsiders. It was an amazing work that just God was part of in that small time. Now, we found that this assembly in Anala in 64, when I went to India, appointed somebody else, and it's continued to do so, and it's been an assembly that has not been able to exist very well without a full-time worker. And that may be one of the legacies that is going to happen once you make assemblies almost dependent on full-time workers, whether you're going to need them all the time. Now, it would be marvellous to appoint full-time workers and hope that they can do themselves out of the job because they've motivated everybody to perform all the functions. I am not sure that always happens. It has not happened in Anala. At the same time, across Queensland, Es Morse moved to Longreach in 1960 and was very much a resident pastor in Longreach. You thought he was an aerial missioner, didn't you, flying all over Western Queensland? Well, so he was. But in many ways, he was the pastor of a Brethren church which grew immensely and had a lot of strength in the 60s, 70s and 80s, and of course, I think is now defunct once Es is gone. So it very much centred around Es now, too, with the Greys and Banahans after them, but it didn't ever function as well once Es Morse left. And on the other hand, you can go also to Emerald, where Alan and Marion Vine were, and they established a church around them at Emerald, almost as resident pastor, and were very effective. Okay, there's one more model, and I've got 5 minutes to go. Let me just go over these, so if you're sleeping and missing some of it, you can at least get the highlights. First of all, we've got the emigrants who established house churches. Secondly, we've got those who switched denomination and sometimes brought people with them. Thirdly, we've got people now converted through evangelistic and itinerant preachers. And that was a very powerful movement. Fourthly, we've got the model then from the 60s on of establishing resident pastors or resident full-time workers, or workers that are going to work more with a single church than just itinerating from place to place. The last model is quite recent, although elements of it occurred in our earlier history, and that is what I've called a holistic mission strategy. Now, this comes from the idea that we should no longer pursue just the soul, but that the church and God is interested in the whole man, his body, his well-being, as well as his spiritual being. Now, we had always done this in our mission to the Aborigines. And as we established missions to Aborigines in Queensland, Western Australia, South Australia, and in a smaller way in New South Wales, we recognised that it was no good just preaching to them, but we went there with a school, we went there with an orphanage, we went there with a hospital, we went there with these social actions, and we tried to bring, as it were, the whole range of Christian benefits to a group of people. We didn't choose that model as we reached ordinary Australians. But more recently we've begun, in part at least, to recognise that if we are going to make an impact in the community, maybe we've got to show some care for other things apart from their nebulous souls. So we've established schools. We've sometimes established orphanages. We might have established a camp, an old people's home, or something else. Now, we've done these social actions, and we've tried then to say we as a community are concerned not only with evangelism through proclamation, but somehow through social action and involvement in the total life of people through establishment of other things. Craigmore is an assembly that comes to mind that certainly put this into some kind of practice. In your own assembly, in your own area here, Pennant Hills, with a variety of operations. And lastly, that I want to refer to is Redcliffe. And the Redcliffe Assembly, which is just outside Brisbane, have put on plans a project which will extend to at least $20 million with the purchase of land for residents to buy, just as ordinary housing land, a Bible college, a hospital, a school, which has already commenced, and the relocating of their assembly. Now, it is an extremely ambitious and bold project. but they almost have the faith, I think, to carry it off. Now, it's amazing. It is not coming out of a whole institution, that is, a whole lot of grouping of assemblies coming together to do this, but it is emerging out of a single assembly. Holistic mission. As we look at the life of Jesus and watch him move about and read his stories, you are conscious that he is doing two things. He is helping people, and often he helps people who ask him for nothing. The blind man outside the temple, Jesus looked at him and said, "Go and wash." The man didn't ask for anything. He may have wished for a few alms. He didn't ask for a thing. So it wasn't always that Jesus acted in response to people's faith. At times he just cared immensely for people. So he said, "I want you to be well." Now it's marvellous in that case that the healing was also linked with the healing of body was also linked with healing of soul. And in Jesus there's no question that the social action and the spiritual activity come together perfectly. It is very hard for us to do that. And whereas once idealistically I would have liked to have said every missionary ought to sort of be concerned with both of these actions, I'm conscious that maybe it is better done as a team rather than one person trying to do both of these things. Jesus could do it. Very few of us can. And so I think these days that maybe when we set up an institution, we may send doctors. Now they need to make sure that they are Christians and the people see that their presence there is because they have a concern for the whole body. But it may be they're not marvellous evangelists and that's not their gift. So we need to complement that with an evangelist. Now, the evangelist won't be a doctor, the doctor won't be an evangelist. But together they will bring this idea of the wholeness of God's mission, which concerns not just souls, but bodies and will. The shalom of God, the peace of God, the well-being of God that he wishes for everybody. And so then we've moved to where we are today. And I guess the last two models are the ones that we are confronted with. And if there is any growth in our churches, often it is because now we've got some kind of resident worker who's trying to make some impact and trying to reach out. Now I know some of you are saying, well, we don't have that, only lay people, and that's marvellous. But most of the churches today, brethren churches, that are growing, you will find have full-time workers. Not all of them, but a large percentage of the ones. Show me some good ones and I'll show you frequently places where there are full-time workers. But the other thing is, there is now this model of holistic mission and ministry, and maybe that's something we've got to make sure that we take on board as we're thinking about the past and trying to make patterns for the future.